When the Egyptian authorities tried to try him a second time, Mazen fled the country. He applied for asylum in France, and he's been living there ever since.
I'm a gay and I'm a Muslim. I'm accepting my homosexuality as I'm leaving my Islam.
He died 3 years ago, and instead of feeling that wave of grief, I didn't feel sadness, and I didn't feel longing. I felt free.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Uganda's High Court sides with lesbian activists, a gay Egyptian exile fights for liberation, and writer Augustine Burroughs recalls a father who never knew best. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sherry Lunn.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the 3 weeks ending January 10, 2009. In a landmark ruling on December 22nd, the High Court of Uganda confirmed that LGBT people have constitutional rights. One of the country's leading activists, Victor Juliet Mukasa, and a friend visiting from Kenya, Yvonne Oyu, had sued the Attorney General following a 2005 raid at Mukasa's home. Documents were seized, and Oyu was arrested and sexually harassed after being forced to undress to prove that she is a woman. Mukasa, active with the human rights group Sexual Minorities Uganda, was not home at the time. Justice Stella Arak Amoko ruled that the raid violated the women's constitutional rights to liberty, privacy, dignity, and protection from unlawful entry, unlawful search, unauthorized seizure, and inhuman treatment. She awarded $5,000 to OU for arbitrary torture and $2,000 in damages to Mukasa. They had waited 17 months for the verdict. This may have been the first time in the East African country that gays or lesbians have taken the authorities to court. Uganda's political and religious leaders repeatedly condemn homosexuality, and consensual adult sex between people of the same gender is punishable by up to life in prison there. Activists brave enough to speak out for equality are routinely threatened, harassed, or attacked. Mukasa said after the ruling that, "It is my dream that justice will come to every human being in Uganda who is oppressed. This does not mark the end," she said. "The struggle continues until every human being is free."
But 9 men in Senegal, including a prominent gay rights activist, were convicted this week of committing homosexual acts and sentenced to 8 years in prison. Diadji Diouf, who heads an organization that provides gay men with condoms and HIV prevention information, was among the 9 arrested in December during an evening raid on his apartment in a suburb of Dakar. None were reportedly engaged in sexual activity, but authorities cited the condoms and lubricants found in the apartment, standard tools in HIV prevention efforts, as proof that illegal sex had taken place. The judge added 3 years to the maximum 5-year sentence for those convicted of unnatural acts because, he said, the men's activities also constituted a criminal conspiracy. Joel Nana, the Cape Town-based Africa Research and Policy Coordinator with the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, told the Associated Press that this is the first case that we've heard of in Senegal where people actually got sentenced. He condemned the harsh punishment, saying that it is a strong message of hatred, a strong message of division, when we know it is critical at this point to address HIV in these communities. The men's attorney said they would appeal the sentences.
Elsewhere in Africa, a group of Ethiopian Protestant, Roman Catholic, and Orthodox religious leaders meeting in Addis Ababa in late December called for a constitutional amendment to criminalize homosexuality. Ethiopia already has a law banning consensual adult same-gender sex, which is punishable by up to 3 years in prison. In a joint statement, the clerics demanded stronger laws, calling homosexuality the pinnacle of immorality, and blamed gays for an increase in sexual attacks on children. The head of Ethiopia's Orthodox Church, Patriarch Adune Palos, said that gays and lesbians are stupid like animals, and that they need to be given a lesson.
But 15 transgender activists from 9 East and Southern African countries met in Cape Town in mid-December in the first ever gathering of its kind. The African Strategy Workshop, organized by the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission and the South African group Gender Dynamics, attracted delegates from Botswana, Burundi, Kenya, Namibia, Rwanda, South Africa, Uganda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The trans activists established priorities for future work, targeting education, access to health care, including hormone treatment and gender reassignment surgery, and arbitrary arrests.
South African Supreme Court of Appeal Judge Edwin Cameron, who is openly gay and HIV positive, was appointed on New Year's Day to the Constitutional Court by President Kgalema Motlanthe. He'll be the first openly gay and HIV positive judge to sit on a nation's highest court. The South African Lesbian and Gay Equality Project praised the appointment, noted that Cameron was among the few lawyers who defended anti-apartheid activists against the old regime, and credited him with helping to pave the way for LGBT equality. South Africa's post-apartheid constitution was the first in the world to ban discrimination based on sexual orientation.
In the U.S., Portland, Oregon's openly gay mayor Sam Adams was sworn in at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Day. About 40 people witnessed the ceremony, including his mother and his longtime partner Peter Zuckerman. Adams has served in city government for several years and was elected to the city council in 2004. He captured 58% of the vote in the mayoral primary race last May, making a later runoff election unnecessary. Portland is now the largest city in the United States with an openly gay mayor.
A lawyer for former U.S. Senator Larry Craig said this week that he won't ask the Minnesota Supreme Court to void Craig's conviction in an airport bathroom sex sting, and that all the legal wrangling over the case is over. The Idaho Republican, who decided not to seek re-election in November, was arrested in 2007 by a police officer who was conducting an undercover operation against men cruising for gay sex at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. The senator quietly pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct and paid a fine, but changed his mind after word of his arrest became public. He's consistently insisted that it was all a misunderstanding and that he's not gay. Meanwhile, tourist interest in the arrest site seems to be waning. One enthusiast even offered to buy the men's room for $5,000, although he was rebuffed. Patrick Hogan, director of public affairs for the Metropolitan Airports Commission, said that, "I think we'll all be glad when there's no special interest in that restroom."
In other news, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit on December 30th to invalidate Arkansas's Act One. That measure, approved by state voters in November, bans any unmarried person who lives with a partner from serving as an adoptive or foster parent. Since same-gender couples can't legally marry in Arkansas, its proponents admitted that the proposal specifically targeted gay and lesbian couples. The suit argues that Act One violates federal and state constitutional rights to equal protection and due process. 29 people from a dozen families are participating in the case as plaintiffs. One is a grandmother who lives with her same-gender partner and is the only relative willing to adopt her grandchild, who's now in Arkansas state care. Several married heterosexual couples are also plaintiffs. They previously had chosen friends or relatives who are coupled but not married to adopt their children in the event of the parents' deaths. Rita Sklar, executive director of the ACLU of Arkansas, said that Act One takes away parents' right to decide for themselves who will adopt their children if they die, and it denies the many children in Arkansas state care a chance at the largest possible pool of potential foster and adoptive homes. State Attorney General Dustin McDaniel said during the election campaign that he opposed Act One, but Chief Deputy Attorney General Justin Allen said this week that McDaniel's office will defend it in court.
In an important nationwide victory for same-gender parents, a U.S. federal district judge in Louisiana has ordered the state registrar to recognize the New York adoption of a baby boy by a same-gender couple. Lambda Legal represented Orrin Adar and Mickey Smith, a gay couple whose adoption of their Louisiana-born son in 2006 was approved by a New York court. Smith later applied to get a new birth certificate for the child in Louisiana, in part to add his son to his health insurance coverage. But state law denies marriage to same-gender couples, and the office of state registrar Darlene Smith told him that Louisiana does not recognize adoption by unmarried parents. Lambda's suit argued that Smith's action violated the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution, under which judgments and orders issued by a court in one state must be recognized as legally binding by other states. U.S. District Judge Jay Zaney's ruling in late December ordered the registrar to issue a birth certificate showing the two men as the boys' parents. Lambda senior staff attorney Ken Upton said the ruling sends a strong message to state officials across the country that the Constitution requires them to respect the parent-child relationships established by adoption decrees, regardless of the state where the decree is entered.
And finally, Queen Elizabeth II announced on New Year's Eve that she will be knighting leading British AIDS activist Nick Partridge, chief executive of the Terence Higgins Trust. He'll be among those invested later this year when Elizabeth traditionally lays a sword on his shoulders. And Stonewall chief executive Ben Summerskill has also been included in 2009's New Year's honors list. He'll become an officer in the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire for services to equality and diversity. Perhaps the UK's leading LGBT advocacy group, Stonewall, celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. It formed in 1989 to fight the notorious Section 28, which banned the so-called promotion of homosexuality by public institutions, including schools. That law was finally repealed in 2003.
That's News Wrap for the 3 weeks ending January 10th, 2009, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
You'll be running with scissors from the wolf at Augustin Burroughs' table later in the program. Homosexuality is not specifically prohibited in Egypt. Still, gay men are regularly arrested on charges of debauchery or offenses against public morality in the predominantly Muslim country. In 2001, 52 men were rounded up in an infamous police raid on a floating nightclub. The Queen Boat was a well-known gathering place for gays in Cairo, the Egyptian capital. 23 of the men were convicted and sentenced to between 1 and 5 years hard labor. One of them was 28-year-old Mazen. He spoke with Radio Netherlands human rights reporter Jonathan Gruber.
I've been arrested outside of this discotheque, and I have spent 1 year in jail because of my homosexuality. I have been judged by the name of Islam, and this was the problem, because they didn't judge me only as a homosexual, but as a heathen, like someone he don't believe in any God, someone he don't believe in anything. So this was the first thing that I have been judged for. We have been tried twice. The first one, it was in 2001, and the second one, it was in 2003, because after 1 year, spending 1 year in prison, we went out under the pressure of the United States and the European Union. They made another judgment, and the second one, it was very clear. They said, we judge these people because they are homosexual.
During his year in prison, Mazen was raped by the guards. After his release, he knew that he had to keep quiet about his ordeal.
Nobody knows that I've been in jail except my family. It wasn't all my family as well, it was only my mother, which was supporting me, because she believed in me, she believed that I'm a good guy, and she believed even... I'm someone who believes in God. I was a very, very good Muslim, and I'm still. But I was practicing that more than right now. She knew that I'm not doing this thing because, as I told you, the first crime, it was like, we don't believe in God, we don't believe in Quran, and we are not Muslim. She believed that I'm not that guy who do this stuff. She told to me, I know that you are not what they said, but are you homosexual? Because they make a relation between the homosexuality and all these things. And my answer was no, of course, because I was not saying to my mother, even if she knows. She knows, but we never talk about that.
When the Egyptian authorities tried to try him a second time, Mazen fled the country. He applied for asylum in France, and he's been living there ever since. Despite everything he's been through, Mazen has not rejected Islam and reconciles his homosexuality and his belief this way.
As a Muslim, as a gay Muslim, I cannot say more than this. I'm a gay and I'm a Muslim. I'm accepting my homosexuality as I'm leaving my Islam. It's not allowing it, but for me, I believe in God, and I believe that in something, God made me like this, and I'm a creation of God. He chose to make me homo. It's something we're born with. Or you're born homo, or you're not born homosexual. So for me, it's something like this. This is what I believe. Being homosexual, it's not a crime. As soon as you don't hurt anybody, as soon as you don't kill anybody, as soon as you don't lie, as soon as you don't do crimes, so you are a good guy. And you do what you believe in. And I still believe in God. I'm still doing what God asked me to do. And I'm still living my homosexuality. I completely agree with that. If I'm trying to do something right now, it's like to stop arresting people, stop making from the homosexuality a crime. This is a struggle, and that's what I'm going to try to do. And that's what I will do for, I think, for the rest of my life. I don't know how to tell you, but it's a very difficult fight. Very difficult. But I have accepted, so no choice right now. I can't go back.
That was Mazen, an Egyptian Muslim who had to flee his country because of his homosexuality. He spoke with Radio Netherlands human rights reporter Jonathan Gruber.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, an informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Where did Augustine Burroughs get his vengeful wit? The author of Running with Scissors blunts his well-known sharp-edged humor in his new memoir, A Wolf at the Table, as he dissects a horrifyingly disturbing relationship with his father. This Way Out queer lit commentator Janet Mason called it clever, contained, and courageous. Now we hear from the openly gay writer himself during his Australian book tour as he chats with our Brisbane correspondent, John Frame.
Augustine Burroughs, welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. Welcome to Brisbane.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It really is.
In Wolf at the Table, you're talking specifically about your experience as a very young man, virtually from childbirth, and especially regarding your relationship with your parents, mostly your father.
I was never going to write about my father. It was something that I felt was just in my past. Much like I felt Running with Scissors, which is my past, and throughout my 20s, I never thought I would write a book about it. And actually, speaking of Running with Scissors, when I did begin writing Running with Scissors, I thought I would include my father in the beginning and start the book earlier chronologically so that people could see and understand that, oh, Running with Scissors was the good part, the happy childhood, that was the dessert. But I could not summarize my father in a chapter or two. It didn't work. It wasn't effective because he could not be summarized. What made that relationship so incredibly terrifying was subtle and needed to be explained. So he died 3 years ago, and instead of feeling that wave of grief, I didn't feel sadness, and I didn't feel longing. I felt free. I felt free for the first time in my life. And now I had been raised by this absolutely wild psychiatrist who believed you were a free person when you were 13. So I've never gone to school. I've never, gone through step A and B and C so you can land, at D. I have been living on my own since I was 16 and working, and I have been free. And when my father died, I realized, no, I haven't. With that awareness came the knowledge that I immediately had to write this book. And I knew it wasn't going to be a funny book. And that's the thing about A Wolf at the Table. It's really not, it's not a funny book. It's not like my other books. It's a brutal, brutal book. It's very disturbing. And I had a 5 seconds of pause. I mean, I knew I was going to write it. That was never a question. But was I going to publish it? And my only concern was, I don't want to let my readers down, and you know, I don't want them to, you know, come here expecting yet another funny thing. But you know, when I thought about it just in another moment, I realized that it seems to me that so many people have come up to me and told me that the favorite part of whatever the book is, it's always often one of the darker or more serious moments. I mean, the material in my book Dry, which is about alcoholism, and it's a love story, a very sad love story. It's the really, really devastating material about the character George, or Pighead, who dies in that book that affects people. In Running with Scissors, it's the rape scene. So I thought maybe people will you know, to accept that from me. But the more important issue was that I can't be the only person with a bad father. And if you go to the bookstore, you would certainly think I am, because all the books about father and son relationships are sports, or their advice from dad to his boy. They're very sentimental books. And they're that's fine. You know, that's fine for a certain segment of the population. But there is a huge number of men, and women too, who did not have the great father, whose father left when the baby was born, or who drank, or who was extremely violent physically or sexually abusive. I mean, it's an unfortunate list, but it is a long list, and it's common. So when I went out on tour with this, I didn't know what to expect. And what I got were the biggest crowds of my career, absolutely massive numbers of people. And so many of them came up to me and said, me too. I was married to that man. That man was my father. That man was my grand, you know, and it was an amazing thing to see the intensity with which people felt, I think, a sense of camaraderie. I mean, when you read a memoir that perfectly expresses what you have felt but not been able to articulate, or when it describes an experience you've had and you've never seen it described before, it's profound. It makes you realize that you're not alone in the world, that you have company. I also had, of course, people come up to me, and this was a surprise, and say, I actually had a great dad. But I wanted to give this to him for Father's Day. And I thought that was I didn't understand it until I thought a little bit more about it. And why would you want to read this book if you've got a wonderful father? And I think it makes people feel grateful, which was a Running with Scissors thing. I mean, you know, obviously lots of people who read that had normal, relatively normal, what we call normal lives, or certainly not to the extent of dysfunction that I experienced. But it's great. I love that. I love having people who had a great dad come up to me, and because they often tell their stories. I had a gentleman here in Australia come up to me, an older gentleman, and the book brought back so many memories for him of just the little things in the book. And he had a great dad, and he started sharing stories of his relationship with his father with me. And while it was as if he was saying, we used to travel to the moon, it was great. You know, it was really great.
Certainly what I found from my experience with the book is that you're actually letting us know how you actually progressed to be who you are. It was a coming of real age for you. Because you tell us that it's not just a matter of surviving childhood. You then, as a young adult, had to endure that you were going through the same situation as your father, having a public image that was one thing, a private life that was really quite messy, but you have actually been able to pull above that. And was that being able to cope, was that when your father died, or were you actually pulling your life together before that happened?
Oh, no. I mean, I've always been pulled together. And you're right. The book does put, I think, the other books in perspective. I would never actually write a book, though, that further explained my life. I'm really in an odd way. I'm not the subject of my books. I mean, I am, but in another way, I'm absolutely not. There's really nothing special or unique about me other than my experiences that I've had, and the fact that I'm able to recall them on the page.
so that with full emotion, so that people, I mean, I may not be the best writer in the world. I may not have a beautiful, I don't have a beautiful vocabulary. I mean, I think of like Lionel Shriver, who's a gorgeous writer, and it's not a pretentious vocabulary that she has at all. She just seems to know the right word. And I don't have that. You know, I know six words basically, but I am, I'm an expert. I'm like a mechanic. I'm really, really good at bending them to do what they need to do, to say what they need to say, so that they can express the exact and precise emotion of that moment. That's something I can do. It was never my goal to give people another installment of my life, you know, like it was more to tell the story of, and I happen to be the writer of it, you know, to tell the story of this relationship with this father. And people, I think, when they read these books, I mean, yeah, they definitely read me and they, you know, they know me. But I think there's, you know, there's a lot of them in the books as well. The funny thing, it's like when Atlanta, Georgia, you know, if there's one place I can read the crudest and most offensive essay anywhere in the world, is Atlanta, Georgia, where it's a Republican audience with very high hairsprayed hair, and the men are in suits and have parts, you know, in their hair like in the 70s, and everyone's gorgeously dressed, and yet, I can say anything because even though the window dressing of my life is perhaps very unfamiliar, very different, very strange, very shocking, the emotion is exactly the same. I mean, that's why the stuff I write about is just really universal. I mean, seeking love from a father, or, you know, wanting to fall in love, or dating all the wrong people. That's what I'm saying. There's really nothing unique or special about me in that sense, other than my ability to recall and to put on the page.
Writer Augustine Burroughs continues his conversation with John Frame about A Wolf at the Table and growing up gay.
I've often asked if I'm proud of being gay, and I'm not. I'm really not. I'm not proud of being gay any more than I'm proud of being right-handed. And the reason for that is because I never struggled with it, and I was never told it was bad. I didn't go to school. You know, I wasn't bullied in high school about it, and when the adopted family, it just was not. It was not. No one ever talked about it. It was no issue. So I never overcame anything. I just have been like this since the dawn of time, and nothing changed.
Next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Sherry Lund, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and John Frame contributed program material. Thanks also to Jonathan Gruber and Eric Beauchemin at Radio Netherlands. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WTIP Grand Marais, Minnesota, 5RRR Woomera, South Australia, KEOS College Station, Texas, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.